Good afternoon. I'm Jane Banner. I'm a member of the Peace and Justice Committee of the Unitarian Church of Evanston, and we've been supportive of the programs of the North Shore Peace Initiative, the Chicago Area Peace Action, as it's now known, for many years, beginning, I believe, in the 1980s with our nuclear-free zone signs. We're now not only a supporter, well, I think we support a lot of good causes, and among other things, we're a green sanctuary program and congregation. So help yourselves to water and iced tea, and feel free to put the cups in the recycling because they are compostable. At any rate, we're glad you're here. I think this is going to be a lovely program, and now I'll turn it over to somebody for who's doing the introductions. Okay, great.
All right, thank you. Thanks, Jane. And over the years, North Suburban Peace Initiative and now Chicago Area Peace Action have done several things at this wonderful location. So thank you again for opening up your space and your heart, I guess, to the things that we all find so important. I'm David Boris. I'm sorry. I'm David Boris. I'm the current president of the board, thank you for asking, of Chicago Area Peace Action. And for years, actually, North Suburban Peace Initiative and subsequently Chicago Area Peace Action, let me just start to tell you, North Suburban Peace Initiative was really founded as part of the Sane Freeze movement, like Jane had mentioned, in 1979. So we've done a variety of different things over the years, mostly focusing on you know, the horror of nuclear weapons and particularly, you know, the tragedy that Hiroshima and subsequently Nagasaki was. 7 or 8 or 9 years ago, we started to bring the messages together on nuclear power generation and nuclear weapons. And at that time, 7 or 8 years ago, we actually had some members in our constituency that questioned that with us and said, you know, look, the conversation about abolition of nuclear weapons doesn't give you the latitude, the mandate to really talk about nuclear power. Over the past several years, I think at Chicago Area Peace Action, we've come to realize that the issues are inextricably linked, that the nations that develop nuclear weapons capabilities almost exclusively do it under the auspices in the beginning of developing peaceful nuclear power programs. When we look at the problems, particularly related to opportunity cost of developing alternative energy and renewable energy resources, when we pour remarkable amounts of money and taxpayer guarantees into the development of what is long-term an unsustainable energy resource. I think that we now realize, and the reason that we chose to make this year's commemoration of the bombings of August 6th and August 9th, linking them to what in our minds now is the most horrific accident that's ever occurred in a nuclear power plant, and sadly, tragically, and coincidentally, in the same country where the United States unleashed the horrific power and destruction of nuclear weapons. So we have brought here today Norma Field, Dr. Norma Field from the University of Chicago. She's the Distinguished Service Professor in Japanese Studies and is teaching a class, interestingly enough, with the exact same title of our presentation here, From Hiroshima to Fukushima. And we're very fortunate to have visiting us from Japan Mr. Yastel Yamada, who is the co-founder of the Skilled Veterans Corps for Fukushima, a group of Japanese retirees who have volunteered to work to spare younger people the exposure to radiation, volunteered to work in that whole area around Fukushima. And I'll let his presentation go forward, and I think it'll be very interesting as you sort of get a flavor of what really happened at Fukushima and sort of get a flavor of how the industries that profit from the proliferation of nuclear energy resources kind of line up to deflect and deter and obfuscate and not really allow the information to come out that would allow a population of billions of people around the world to make intelligent decisions and understand where we really should be going in this arena. I do want to mention just a couple of things. On your chairs, Dr. Field had put together a wonderful resource list for us. So she called it a very partial resource list, but I think it will start out for you as a great beginning to get a little more education on the subject. We do have on our Chicago Area Peace Action website, that's shypeaceaction.org, a petition that we've got hard copy of here, which you could sign here, or I'm going to let Roxanne quickly tell you what to do if you don't want to sign that here.
Yeah, we can make it really easy for you because we have live computers. The church has Wi-Fi, so we've got live computers waiting for you on your way out today. We'll just key in your signature, and you don't have to fill it in pen. Go ahead and come see me or Catherine or anybody with a computer. But if you write legibly, you can certainly fill that in and hand it to us on the way out as well.
Roxanne's our one and only staff person at Chicago Area Peace Action. So if you have other questions on that, or if you're looking to sign up today, if you haven't paid your membership dues yet for the year, Roxanne would be happy to take a check from you today. Right? $40, I think, is basic membership dues for Chicago Area Peace Action. Finally, at 6:15 this evening at Water Tower Place, which is across the street from the Japanese Council in Chicago, will be a vigil, and 6:15 p.m., or 6:16, I guess, p.m., right, will be exactly 67 years to the day, to the hour, to the minute of the dropping of the atomic bomb, Batman, on the unsuspecting citizens of Hiroshima, Japan. So if you want to try to make that. And then finally, on our website also, we will show Nuclear Energy Information Service, Dave Kraft's organization, who's done yeoman work on this subject for a couple of decades now. We'll be showing a film on August 23rd. That date will be shown up on our website also, called Fukushima Never Again. So without, I hope, further ado, are we almost ready to, with a little amplification? But that's all right. Norma can hold it, I think, and then we'll tape it on. Okay. Okay, great. Well, let's tape it on then. And then I will turn the program over to Dr. Norma Field. Norma, yes. And you may be able to project a bit until we get this working. All right, good, good, good.
I prefer to stand.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Do we have
I'll be sorry, but is it okay if I sit?
Yes, absolutely.
This can come down.
We can drop that. We can put you comfortably here. We don't need the PowerPoint until after, right?
Right.
So can I just power it down?
Why not? I'm saying yes, but I have no authority.
And let's just move this over here. And does that give you
Yeah, it
room?
Gives me plenty.
And I think
room.
We can just do this
yeah,
also.
That sounds
so
good.
So that people can see you clearly.
Yeah.
And a little water for you.
I got myself some water.
Perfect.
I'm self-servicing.
All right. You would think. It's good. All right. Good. So let me introduce Dr. Norma Field. Thank you very much.
Everybody. I'm going to, hi, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. I hope you can hear me. No, I really actually prefer to talk standing, but I also like to have notes, and then I might lose my balance, and I can't see the time, and I might overrun, which I don't want to do, so allow me to sit. If at any point I start talking to myself, please raise your hand, okay? It could be talking to myself in many ways, but I hope not. I hope it's technical volume only. Are we okay? I suppose I should say a word about why I'm here, what got me in, involved in the atomic bomb issues. I was born and raised in Tokyo. I was born in 1947 of an American father who went to the Japan as part of the U.S. occupation after the war, met and married my Japanese mother. Now, everyone here has an earliest memory. You know, it could be a smell, the smell of coffee or whatever. My earliest memory that I can consciously invoke is of my parents arguing over breakfast about U.S. atmospheric testing in the Pacific. And my father, of course, was saying, we've got to do it because of those commies. And my mother was saying, it's so dangerous and it exposes so many people to radiation. I imagine this is in the early 50s, 1952 or so. So that's my earliest memory. And then this, my second connection with this whole issue that brings us together today is of seeing an image. Many of you may have seen it, but the actual sight is much less vivid in Hiroshima. I need to backtrack, sorry. The United States censored all information on the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, did not allow images to be circulated for a number of years, certainly throughout the occupation, till 1952. And these images didn't get around. It's only in 1980 that a number of Japanese citizens pulled their money together to buy 10 feet of film at a time from the U.S. archives. Images circulated before them, but that's the major moment at which moving images come in. But as a 10-year-old or so, with the first TV my family had accessible, I remember seeing a silhouette of a boy sitting on steps, and he had literally been vaporized. And I found that so stunning and horrific that I promised myself then that someday I would teach. And my whole purpose in becoming a teacher would be to keep Japan and the U.S. from going to war again. That was as far as my mind could grasp geopolitics at the time. Now, I have subsequently found teaching a course on the atomic age at the University of Chicago that most young people are simply not horrified by any sort of image anymore. And they have told me so. And it's not completely true because the minute you add captions, they're suddenly vulnerable, which is an interesting thing to think about. But images, they tell me, cannot horrify them. And there's something to that. And there's also, as a teacher who looks for images with which to horrify people, I know that your own defenses or whatever, your own sensibility gets numbed and you keep looking for something more and more shocking, which is not a happy condition to be in. So what I want to do today is to start out with a poem, which for me is the thing that always brings me back to that moment, you know, before Hiroshima, before Chernobyl, or now Fukushima, which is where we always are poised. This is a poem written by a woman in 1952, August of 52, so a very early anniversary commemoration, and she had just seen the first photographs that were made available of the impact of the atomic bomb, and she went to her workplace, was shown the picture, and said, hey, you compose a poem because we're going to commemorate this tomorrow, and she had an hour in which to write this poem, and this is the poem which I translated roughly a few days ago. So let me read you that. It's called Greetings Upon Seeing an Atomic Bomb Photograph. This burnt, raw face of August 6th, 1945 belongs to one who was in Hiroshima at the time, one of the 250,000 burnt, raw persons no longer of this world. Still, my friend, let us turn to look each other in the face once again. Faces without a trace of the flames of war. Today's face, radiant with health. Morning's face, fresh. When I search there for the expression tomorrow could bring, a shudder passes through me. The earth holds several hundred nuclear weapons. You walk along the precipice separating life and death. How can you be so serenely beautiful? Listen, can you hear something coming? What needs to be seen is before your eyes. What needs to be chosen is in the palm of your hand. 8:15 a.m. comes around every day. That morning of August 6, 1945, all those 250,000 people who died instantly were, like you, like me, serenely beautiful, caught off guard. That's the end. And more than any actual photograph of dripping flesh or more graphic representations that you can get through animation, this poem has me in its grip still. And it is something that hasn't loosened at all with the internet age. It seems to me that we are always at that moment where we could be caught off guard. And we never believe that this is something, that this catastrophe is something that could come to us. So this image, this idea of our being trapped in this moment, this long, long moment of always being caught off guard, I think applies both to nuclear disaster through the deployment of weapons and through nuclear disaster through nuclear power plants. And I suppose I should also say that this moment isn't one of safety anyway, because the nuclear power plants in their normal operations are always emitting forms of radiation. I want to, and so for that on the Japan side, and for us who are inhabitants of Illinois, many of us, I suppose, there's also the signal connection we have that the first sustained nuclear chain reaction took place on the campus of the University of Chicago. It had occurred to me to be a little curious about why you would be playing around with something like this in the middle of a university campus in the middle of a city. And it turns out that there was a strike going on at Argonne, and that's why it had to be moved from Cook County Forest Preserve, this first daunting experiment, to the campus of the University of Chicago, and that's why we have Henry Moore's sculpture commemorating that spot, that signal achievement of humanity, plunging us towards total destruction. And the remnants are now in Cook County Forest Preserve, so I recommend that you can find information through Wikipedia. So you might want to take a Sunday stroll sometime through Cook County Forest Preserve and find the two sites where the remnants of the first reactors are buried, the Chicago Pile, as it came to be known. But I want to focus not on that physical side of this age, of this early part of our nuclear age, but something else, that we should all be mindful that there were second thoughts about this almost from the very beginning. And what I'm referring to is the July 17th petition of the Manhattan scientists. How many of you know about this? Yeah? Bunch of you. Yeah, good. I'm glad to see that. This is a petition addressed to the President of the United States, that is to say, President Truman. And do you also know that Truman's grandson, Clinton Truman Daniel, a journalist, 55 years old, is in Hiroshima right now? Has any of you read about that? It's very interesting to think that his grandson is there at this very charged moment. In any case, it is the Manhattan scientists, a large number of them, really mobilized by the Hungarian Leo Szilard, who was very key to the physics that went to developing the bomb, who was running around frantic to get his message to Truman. He got Einstein to cooperate with him, and he had this petition, the July 17th petition, July 17th, 45, so very close, right, to the date. And it reads, the key part of it reads, asking Truman, quote, that you exercise your power as commander-in-chief to rule that the United States should not resort to the use of atomic bombs in this war unless the terms which will be imposed upon Japan have been made public in detail, and Japan, knowing these terms, has refused to surrender. But there's a second following upon that, even so, that in such an event, the question whether or not to use atomic bombs be decided by you in the light of the consideration presented in this petition, as well as, and this is key, all other moral responsibilities which are involved. So this is July 17th, 1945. A number of times when I take up this material in courses, students will say, but they didn't know what it really involved. Well, they knew well enough, these scientists, well enough that they were trying to get the President of the United States not to use this newfound, wonderful gadget. This petition was signed by 71 scientists at the Manhattan Project's Metallurgical Laboratory, aka MetLab, at the University of Chicago. The mission of that lab was to produce the plutonium for atomic bombs. It was signed by 67 scientists at the Oak Ridge facility in Tennessee, where uranium-235 was separated from 238 to prepare the uranium core for the Hiroshima bomb. 18 at Oak Ridge wanted to modify the end, interestingly, to say that responsibility for use of atomic bombs is shared with our allies. They wanted shared responsibility written in, but they signed the petition. And only two Oak Ridge scientists signed a counterposition petition saying that the Szilard petition was a security risk. And, quote, this is the common alpha and omega that I have encountered in the discussion of the atomic bombs. If we can save even a handful of American lives, then let us use this weapon now, was what the two counter-petition signatories stated. So that is often an issue. It saved American lives, and if we want to really make a strong case, it saved Japanese lives too. An argument based on something that didn't happen, so I don't know how we can make such a strong case. And in any case, whatever the limits of knowledge on the part of the president and others then, we have no excuse to plead ignorance now. I want to briefly address, and I'm going fast, I hope not too fast, because I really want to save time for Mr. Yamada and a lot of time for Q&A, but I want to touch on the question that or the comment that so many people make after March 11th, 2011, like, why did it have to happen in Japan of all places? Isn't that ironic? And the answer is yes, and at the same time, overwhelmingly no, that it made complete sense that it should happen in Japan, or it could have happened in France, or it could have happened here in Illinois, the most nuclear state in the Union. But it's not. If it's ironic, it's in this sense. First of all, Japanese as well as German scientists were very much involved in developing a nuclear weapon in the late 30s and 1940s. It's the dual promise that has really been, what to call it, Aladdin's lamp, the sorcerer's apprentice, this dual nature that the promise of unlimited energy on the one hand and the promise of the capacity to destroy your enemy and, by the way, yourself. And it seems that we have, in the 60-some, close to 70 nuclear years, always played one against off against the other. So now you see the destructive side, now you don't, and somehow you keep making excuses. It was very helpful for me to hear David Boris talk about arguments presented about or wariness about taking on the nuclear power issue here. But so there was that imperative in Japan anyway, and also something that often comes up. Well, scientists can't be stopped in their quest for knowledge, right? And scientific progress is something so special that no one should get in the way. So there was that to begin with. And then secondly, yes, that devilish phrase, atoms for peace. It's ironic that Eisenhower, of course, as a military commander, thought that the atomic bombs had not been needed. He had a different emphasis once he became president. He saw that once we're in the nuclear age, people use whatever tools they have at hand, so they're going to use nuclear weapons. Nuclear warfare will be was on the verge of becoming normalized, in his view, which alarmed saner heads, as there were back then. And then Eisenhower in France and Britain. And Eisenhower thought, I just don't want to be always being attacked for promoting nuclear war. Hence the Atoms for Peace program, whereby nuclear technology, civilian technology, would be proffered our allies. By the way, in Eisenhower's term, we went from 1,000 nuclear warheads to 22,000. That is under the regime of the man who announced Atoms for Peace. So keep that in mind whenever you hear Atoms for Peace. And moreover, you know about how we're excited about, hot and bothered about Iran these days. And, of course, they, Iran, Pakistan, they got their first nuclear reactors under this program. So, as usual, we are right in it at the beginning. There was something astonishing. How many of you know have ever heard of the Stockholm Appeal, 1950? Anybody? Yeah. Huge. I mean, extraordinary campaign. Even if you say the people in the Soviet orbit were all voting, that still doesn't cancel it. 1950 Stockholm Appeal that called for the absolute banning of nuclear weapons. 273.5 million signatories worldwide. Remember, this is before Facebook. 6.4 million in Japan and 3 million in the United States. It comes to coincide with the Red Purge in Japan. It becomes an important part of it, whereby the U.S. priorities switched from making sure that Japan was free of its militarist runaway quasi-fascist leadership to making sure that Japan was a useful ally in our geopolitical programs, i.e. let's make it possible to rearm Japan and so forth and so on. It was kind of swapping prisoners in jail, you know, from the prime ministers, the Class A war criminals, to labor union activists who walked from door to door circulating the petition for the Stockholm Appeal. Unfortunately for the United States, the Atoms for Peace was announced in December 53, March of 1954, with the insouciance of military folk in the Castle Dragon, is that what it was? In the Bravo shot over Bikini, the United States explosion was many times more powerful than planned and irradiated a Japanese tuna vessel along with many other people in the area. And that generated a campaign, anti-nuclear campaign, by housewives, is the language normally used in Tokyo, and again, before Facebook and Twitter, 32 million signatures in 54. This is also when Godzilla develops and so forth and so on. The U.S. and the proponents in Japan who wanted Japan to get nuclear technology, and for the leadership, I am very certain this had to do with being tacitly a nuclear power, not nuclear energy only, but nuclear power. And Americans... many on the American side came up with reasoning of because of Hiroshima, this is the part that's not ironic, because of Hiroshima, therefore we owe this. As Christians, in order to make up for what we did in Hiroshima, we owe them this new technology. So there was that kind of reasoning and a huge PR campaign. The Japanese people were quickly gotten over what was called their nuclear allergy. And that is how we have the nuclear village. We have kind of seemingly completely blinkered and deaf responses on the part of the Japanese government to restarting nuclear energy, the power plants. And I think the dual purpose of an energy source and being a latent nuclear power that keeps the 1% in Japan absolutely determined to stay on course. Now, I want to touch a little bit on the social consequences of the disaster in Fukushima, because Mr. Yamada can tell us very expertly about what the material, the technological consequences are and the terrible pickle we're all in. And to do so, I'd like to quote Ms. Muto. She sort of appeared from nowhere and became a national heroine at one of the first large demonstrations on September 19th last year. She comes from Fukushima. She has been an anti-nuclear activist since Chernobyl, which is, she said, after Chernobyl, I started studying about nuclear power. And her reason for her, the first reason she will give you for becoming an anti-nuclear activist is she says, I do not want to live off energy that necessarily requires radioactive exposure on the part of other human beings. And she's talking about the whole process from uranium mining, often by indigenous peoples, whether in the United States or Australia. She doesn't want to be dependent on that, on the people who work in nuclear power plants, on the people who transport spent fuel. So I have to somehow figure out a different way to live. And she pretty much was managing to live off the grid and using natural things in her environment to have a cafe, which, of course, she's been wiped out of her means of livelihood. You can find a lot of that, including spectacular slides of her pre-March 11th life, as well as her, did I leave off my own website? I may have. In the middle of your resource sheet, there's something called the Atomic Age, and this is a site I'm maintaining with colleagues. It's a University of Chicago site, which is, again, ironic, right? University of Chicago and its role in nuclear power. You can find a great deal of that information, so please click on that somewhere. But Ms. Muto, in her speech, her theme is "We have been divided." I think of her as a very astute activist, too, because she is always warning people, don't set up false enemies. You know, the people who are arguing with you right now about this are not the real enemy, probably. And this is what she said about how we in Fukushima were divided early on. So, quote, "Caught between the campaign launched ever so quickly to proclaim our safety on the one hand and our own uncertainty on the other, the ties holding us together have been sundered. In our neighborhoods, our workplaces, at school and at home, how many of us have suffered and grieved. Like it or not, decisions are pressed upon us every day, to flee or not to flee, to eat or not to eat, to hang out our wash or not to hang out our wash, to make our children wear face masks or not to force them." You can imagine how hard when your kids' schoolmates aren't wearing face masks to persuade them to wear something that nobody else is. "To till our fields or not to till them. To protest to someone, something, or remain silent. All manner of agonizing decisions have confronted us." And this is all overlaid on an increasingly economically stratified society. So you can see that the economic, you know, can you afford to flee or not? Can you afford to buy more expensive, safe food? What can you tell your children? Do you risk social ostracism by complaining to your child's school or daycare authorities that you're worried about their food sources? How can you do that every day? If you're a single mother, how can you have the energy to be informed about what food and water is safe for your child? As Ms. Muto says, people eventually become exhausted and they don't want to learn anymore because they feel helpless. And once you have a nuclear disaster, it's in every pore of your being, because you're breathing it, you're drinking it, you're ingesting it through food, and even the places that are not hot spots are also through food circulation and water and air circulation. The whole archipelago, and let us know, we know that the archipelago is not bounded by a magical boundary. The rest of the world is being exposed to the consequences of Fukushima as it was to Chernobyl. So two quick examples of the kinds of things that come up. One is in that region that was within the 20-kilometer range, an ancient, like over 1,000-year festival, ritual of chasing wild horses is being revived at full scale this year. And everyone, at least advertising the site, reporting on it, is very excited. But you have to say, yeah, but who is this good for? Is it good for the horses? Is it good for the tourists it's attracting? Yeah, the tourists bring some money in. Is it good for the riders? Is it good to give the impression that this place is safe? At the same time, as an outsider, what position are you in to criticize something that brings energy and joy to these devastated people? It's a very, very hard place, and there are countless occasions like that. The spreading of debris that's been portrayed as a patriotic act. You're not willing to accept debris from northern Japan. Well, what kind of Japanese are you? Well, if you really care about the well-being of all Japanese people, you keep the debris where it is instead of turning it into a patriotic duty to share in the pain. Don't ruin the whole land. So that kind of problem. Another very interesting article, because usually when we talk about discrimination, and let me tell you that Fukushima makes you get what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki in a new way. Discrimination about marriage, for example. Young men in Fukushima seeking women to marry them are having a really hard time. Now, it's curious that it's not women who are being highlighted, because usually when we talk about, you know, worrying about the next generation, it's the women who are condemned. And this is not to say the women aren't in a terrible place, but it's interesting to have the men have the spotlight on them. And I suppose, and they are complaining about discrimination. Well, Is it discrimination for those on the young men on the receiving end who can't find young women to marry them through these agencies? Of course it's experienced as discrimination, it is. But for the young women, people, I think we can all of us understand, don't really want to move to Fukushima, right? And this comes back to the government of Japan having so narrowly defined the evacuation zone so as not to have to take financial and other responsibility for evacuating large. So many, 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 many people have remained in Fukushima who should not have. And then you have all these other social ramifications of economic inequities, those who get compensation, those who don't. There you start identifying people to blame who shouldn't be blamed. And now you have men who are feeling bereft of marriage partners unfairly. And it is unfair, but it's not because Japanese women are out to discriminate against them. These are the decisions that you are faced with individually and socially if you have a nuclear disaster befall you. I can't finish, I'm finishing up now, but without having mentioned brought up the cancer issue. The great majority of scientists will say you can't prove a cause and effect relationship between these exposures, even in Chernobyl. And by the way, on the website I pointed out to you, the Atomic Age in Chicago, in the resources, there is a link to this massive Slavic language study. It's Yavlikov, Nestorenko, Yavlikov, which very curiously, the Western language sources, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the UN people, and others, for some reason, on the Chernobyl accident, don't seem to have been consulting Slavic language resources, which is weird, right? You'd think that they could think about research done in the language of the region where languages of the region where the disaster took place, but you can link to that, where you find a very different picture of the cost of Chernobyl. But so many people will say, from Fukushima, the results are going to be so negligible, it's not even worth setting up a research design. I've read that too. Well, as Dr. Helen Caldicott, one of the founders of Physicians of Social Responsibility, will tell you, you can't say your cancer, my cancer, was caused by this. By Three Mile Island, by the Pacific Islands testing, or this and that. Because, first of all, we live in such a toxic environment anyway, and that these toxins and radiation have a synergistic effect. And I don't know who in their sane mind would not want to try to reduce the toxicity of our environment. Why be content to keep adding radiation to that mix? And I suspect that if I were to ask you the question, who in this audience has cancer or has family members or close friends who have wrestled with cancer, I'm suspecting that almost all of your hands would go up. And the organization that first hosted, the website of the organization first hosting Mr. Yamada, called Fukushima Response, and they're hoping to set up chapters around the country. Dr. Carol Wolman, a psychiatrist who's been very active on peace anti-nuke issues, says there are many things we can do to get, and we have to get over our indifference and our fear. And one of them, she says, is we have to get over the social taboo of bringing up the nuclear power plant issue with our friends and neighbors. And I think about what is that fear about? Part of it is fear, right? Fear of cancer. We're all afraid of cancer, although cancer is by no means the only health problem. There are legion others, cardiovascular illnesses and thyroid problems among them. And maybe some of you have heard the expression, the Chernobyl necklace, because so many people have had thyroid problems. There's that fear, and then there's the economic fear. In communities in the United States that store depleted uranium, people don't want people doing research on it because their real estate values will go down. And I think that's also very true for a community siting nuclear power plants. Don't look at the unusual cancer incidences in your community because that plant is safe and it funds excellent schools for us. I think it's impossible to have individual solutions to this, and that's why we have to think about social and government solutions too. We have to pressure the government into being socially responsible so that we can do something about what imperils us all. So I want to say, how many times as a species can we be caught off guard and survive? And that's the message I'd like to leave you with.